Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Chalkett.
And this is Core Intuition. Find other nerds and talk to them.
Well, Manton, the weeks have turned to days, and now we wait just a few more days. We're going to be flying out to San Francisco for, I have to be honest, Manton, it feels like I'm just legitimately going to WWDC. It doesn't feel like I'm going to the outskirts, the reject land of WWDC wannabe attendees. And yeah, maybe it will feel differently. I'm sure it will feel differently when I casually walk up to the steps of Moscone West and realize
I tackle
that,
you and yeah, push you off to the side.
I look in through those gleamingly clean windows at the beautiful App Store icon art dangling from the ceiling, and I'll be like, oh, I should have gone.
Yeah.
But I, in the preamble and the leading up, I'm just, I'm excited about all the stuff that happens necessarily as a side effect of WWDC happening. Like, I know in a week's time, we won't be doing much programming, although you said you want to try to do some, get some programming breaks during the week at the show. But I am pretty sure we will have the option to be using, let's face it, you know, a lot of people say like, oh, is Apple going to have a new iPhone, new Mac Pro? There's room for doubt for all that stuff, because it is just a developer show after all. But what's almost certain, if you ask me, is something like a new beta of Xcode 5.
Yes.
Right? And
new, they've all pretty much said, too, that there'll be developer seeds of iOS 7, macOS 10.9. So Xcode, I'm sure, will be part of that as well.
Right. And, you know, one thing that always happens in my memory, at least, at WWDC over the past several years has been the developer tools, like, gets its own big session, like, right, like state of the union developer tools, and there's always like oohs and ahs when they're like, oh, now you can sometimes it's stuff that we ooh and ah, and then shortly after we're like, get that out of my Xcode, like right. like fix, remember fix and continue.
Mm-hmm.
That was an oohs and ahs moment. It was like the crowd was transfixed by this feature where you could fix a bug in your code and then just keep running, and it didn't really work that well, I think, and as it played out. But this is what it all comes down to for developer tools at WWDC. We get to see this beautifully contrived demo of something that relates very directly and viscerally to some frustration that we all have with our developer tools today, and then hope beyond hope that it actually follows through on that.
Those sessions are interesting, but they've never been like my favorite sessions, like the top things that I want to see, because I mean they're tools, I mean they're stuff we use every day, but I don't get excited in the same way if there's a new layout to Xcode or new buttons in different places or whatever, in the same way that I would get excited about actual new APIs that I can make my apps better for users with. I don't know if that's just me, but I almost think that these kind of whiz bang, wow, oohs and ahs that you're talking about, that's great in a keynote, but does it even really work for developer tools? Maybe developer tools should just consistently get better every year, a little bit better, a little bit faster, more robust, don't crash as much. Maybe they don't need to have the oohs and the ahs and the, you know, I'm going to blow your mind with this new feature.
Oh, I disagree, Manton.
Really? All right.
Well, you get some of these oohs and ahs are really worth celebration, and they stand the test of time. Things like Clang. Like when Clang was announced with LLVM, it was like, what? Are you kidding me? You're going to come up with an all new compiler that's not, you know, shackled by the GNU GDB license, and it's going to make it so you can integrate all these cool features into the IDE. Clang analysis. Remember they demoed that? I was like, I have to leave San Francisco, take a flight back home so I can just spend the next like 2 weeks analyzing my code and finding bugs.
But that's not, to me, that's not one of the oohs and ahs things. That's a, we haven't added any, I mean, they have added features, but like we've rewritten things to be more robust is how I've used some of that stuff. Where the oohs and ahs I'm talking about are like, now interface builder is inside of Xcode and you can drag this in here, or now this storyboard UI does this sort of thing. That's the kind of thing that seems to be
right.
Like, we're really impressing you with this stuff you can do without writing any code, and how much better the tool is to work with. And that's the stuff that just doesn't seem to hold up in a big way.
I think it often does fall. It does fall short of what we expect after the demo. But let's face it, Xcode, for all of its faults these days, Xcode combined with the tool chain that comes, you know, all the LLVM oriented cool chain. I call it the cool chain. Hey, step aside, tool chain. It's time to meet the cool chain.
You should be doing these sessions, really hyping up these products.
There's a lot of stuff, man. I am disappointed here. You are not excited enough about Clang, LLVM, LLDB. You can write macros in LLDB using Python. How cool is that?
Yeah, no, that's cool stuff. I don't use... You say you have always been more lower-level debugging kind of guy, though. I don't use that stuff very often.
All right. Well, what is it that excites you? What are you looking forward to? It's going to be like something like... API is now available that makes Manton's next dream app 150% easier to build.
See, that doesn't even excite me that much. That's good. That's stuff that things that make things easier to build, that's great, and that will save you time over years. Like I'm working on something now where I'm totally taking advantage of like not declaring instance variables and, you know, properties everywhere and using Arc so I don't have to deal with anything. I mean, that stuff is nice and it does make code simpler and hopefully less buggy. But I don't get excited about that stuff because it doesn't add any significant, you know, like I can build apps exactly the same before that stuff as after. The stuff that I'm excited about is like brand new, you know, widgets and controls, you know, like the collection view.
We finally found it. This is what gets Manton excited.
You know, stuff where it's like it's dramatically different, where Apple has spent a bunch of time building something new that you can do in the UI or some underlying framework where, you know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of lines of code behind this new feature that you would have had to written yourself, right? That's the stuff that's really compelling to me.
So like iCloud, if it works.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. The big stuff, the game changing kind of stuff where tomorrow when iOS 7 ships, you can build an app that just was impossible before. It just wasn't feasible to build before.
So like not being negative, going back and me like taking a dramatic shift in my personality and not being negative, something like core animation.
Right.
Was like a super serious, huge, big time home run, right?
Huge, yeah.
And there's probably other stuff that if we got out of our negativity trap, we could probably appreciate more things. But those are the kinds of things you never know a given WWDC. You never know when you're going to get something that's like...
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's actually kind of a home run. And
there's always a couple things like that, you know?
Yeah. And one of the keys, I think, taking this back to like a business perspective, which is what we are ostensibly supposed to be talking about here often, one of the things I often try to gear myself up for with WWDC, and I painfully always really kind of fail to follow through on this, is I often go into the conference or even just into the news from the conference with my ears and eyes open to what new technology can I be like one of the first to adopt. mm-hmm. right? Because that's like a huge advantage. If you know, again, assuming like iCloud works, they announced it, and then like if your app had iCloud syncing on day one,
mm-hmm.
you're kind of cool, right? You're going to get featured by Apple. You're going to have yep. all this cool stuff. Your users are going to be like, I love you. You're going to sell a million copies, et cetera. And similarly with all these other features, if you had core animation, like on day one, you would stand above the crowd. And then there's other stuff like whole new, like, not like platforms, but whole new, like segments of, Apple's like ecosystem that sometimes come out and you're like, oh, like I could make like a iBooks book or something.
Mm-hmm.
And
Passbook, like
right? Yeah. Adopting all these new technologies can really help you out. So I'm like going into this thinking like, all right, you know, do my like tap dancing here, get myself agile and like ready to be responsive when I hear the news that what is it going to be, Manton? Any idea?
A new blogging API that makes blogging. It one line of code to write a blogging app.
Wow, you know, it's funny enough that you mentioned that. There's been a lot more, kind of a surprisingly large number of blogging apps coming out lately. What's
yeah,
going
there
on?
Really is.
And
yeah.
just today, as we're recording this on Tuesday, there was an announcement of Byword 2.0
mm-hmm.
that is now a blog publishing app.
Right. The app is normally, you know, a text editor. It's great for Markdown. And then I think it's a $5 in-app purchase, right? And you can add,
yep.
you know, publish to WordPress or I think Evernote and some other things too. And yeah, that definitely, I'm seeing that too. I mean, I use Marzetta on the Mac, of course, but it does seem like there are more and more of these little apps trickling out. And most of them are very specific, like it only works with Tumblr, only works with
right.
WordPress. But there's certainly a lot compared to a few years ago.
I'm encouraged by it, to be honest, because you know you can look at it as competition. But one of the things that scares the bejesus out of me when it comes to Mars Edit, for example, is if there's no competition, you don't really have a market. So it's like mm-hmm. I'm always kind of reassured when I have competition, because otherwise, it's just like this extremely small niche audience that you are serving, and that's fine. But I always think if there's no competition, I should be getting into a market that has competition.
Interesting.
So I think, like, to me, it's like a great sign. Because look at it this way, Manton. Every one of those potential competitors to Mars Edit that gets released, or, you know, Byword comes out, Byword has a big customer base, and Byword is doing me a service right now by introducing this giant customer base to the idea of blog publishing from a native app. And a lot of those folks just maybe like Byword. Maybe they use Byword to like copy and paste into their WordPress or their Tumblr right now. And that's just like, that's getting them to tip their toes into the water of this whole market that I exist in. So
yeah. Well, I think it is good for you, and especially since you have a sort of broader support for different blogging platforms. When you do decide to do an iOS version, you know, you'll have a leg up on these other people in terms of, you know, blogging support and whatnot. So I think that's good. But going back to the thing you said about if I didn't have competition, I'd want to get into a market that had competition.
Yes.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but I don't think I would approach it that way, because I don't know. I mean, there's always this kind of trade-off of, you know, do you try to build something brand new that no one's done, or do you try to build something that other people have done but just do it much better? And you can be successful either way. And there is a risk, admittedly, of building something brand new, because it's possible that it's brand new because no one wanted it and there wasn't demand for it. But still, I mean, just building something that someone has already done, that doesn't...
Manton, I love this, because we are very rarely so diametrically disagreed. And this is one of those times.
Yes.
Because
Two times in a show.
We're just in a disagreeable mood, aren't we? But I think it's great if you can come up with something new that's an all new idea that nobody ever thought about before. You know, if you can be like Dave Weiner and come out with the Outliner or whatever, that's great. It is risky, and you lose all of the benefits of the population, your target market, already being educated about the pros and cons of an app like what you're making. So, like, just to take a completely canonical example of a company that did what I'm suggesting, going after a market that has competition, Flexibits.
Mm-hmm.
Who in their right mind would go after calendars when Apple ships a calendar with the OS on both, right, both platforms, iOS and on the Mac?
Yep. And not only are you competing with that, I remember when I was on the beta for this before it shipped, I remember when he kind of pitched the idea, Michael Simmons pitched the idea about what it was. And not only are you competing with Apple, but I remember at the time there were a couple other sort of menu bar calendar things, like Today from Justin Williams was kind of like that. And so it seemed like there was competition all over the place. But with that, there was two things, right? The one is the two things. The design was amazing, but also the natural language sort of input thing was really compelling. And so that, in a way, it's kind of reinventing an idea that's already been done, but it also, if you take it from the view of how you're inputting events, it's something fairly new.
Well, I'm not saying don't add anything new. I'm not saying make a clone of, you know, well, it's funny. So we just mentioned Byword has gotten into blog publishing. Mm-hmm. What's funny is that whole market, like simplified markdown editors, is one that has consistently attracted my attention. So it'll be funny. Right. It'll be funny if I end up one day going into their market. I'll come to their town and I'll take on their product for a change.
Yeah. You'll have an in-app purchase to save a text file.
That's right.
That'll be here.
But, you know, it makes sense because I already do a bunch of junk with markup and markdown and HTML and all this stuff. Sure. And I look at those apps, and that's another great example, actually, of a market that is extremely crowded.
Yeah.
How many of those apps? There's so many. Writeroom, Byword, IA Writer, mm-hmm, right? All these things. There's all of those that I just mentioned, and there are many more. All of the ones I just mentioned have extremely passionate, fired up fan bases.
Right.
And that's a huge, thriving market. I think that in a market like that, you see something like that, and you can say, do I care at all about this type of product? And if I do, how is each of these participants in the market doing it less well than I could?
Yeah. I wonder, though, if text editors are a special case, because everyone types text and has to save it. And I'm not saying it's such a special case that your argument's not right. Cause I mean, I totally hear what you're saying about, you know, good, healthy markets that have competition and being successful in them. But text editors, I mean, everyone needs one, and most people have bought several.
Yeah. And yet the operating system also comes with a text editor.
True.
And they say, I mean, it's an interest. I think you're right. You're onto something that everybody uses one for the most part. Similarly with mail apps, right? Or you know, everybody uses a mail app. The fact that 95% probably use an operating system's bundled mail app or Gmail or Yahoo online doesn't mean that it wasn't kind of an exciting market for apps like Sparrow to get into. Not that they made any money before they sold for however many millions of dollars. Anyway, I don't know. This is something, I think it's interesting that we see this a little bit differently, because I just don't, maybe it also speaks to the fact that I don't have that much confidence about coming up with something all new. It's sort of nice when somebody writes the playbook, so to speak. Actually, an example of an app that I came up with that was more or less all new was FlexTime. Weird little app. I believe that was what John Gruber described it as too, when he mentioned it when it came out. He's like, I don't really know what this app is. But that didn't work out so well for me. You know, it had a little bit of a niche fan base, and it still does. But there's something maybe from being kind of burned in that respect, and then from, you know, in celebrating and enjoying the success I've had with Mars Edit, but also knowing that it's a niche market that's kind of hard. It's a hard sell. Mm-hmm. 95%, I think, of the people I meet, even like at WWDC or someplace where you would think, you know, desktop blogging would be like a cool idea, they're just kind of there's something about it that I can't even like sell it to a lot of people that I think would really benefit from it. So,
Yeah. And it's also, we're making it a little bit kind of black and white with like new idea versus existing market. Sometimes it's hard to tell, and sometimes it's all how you view it. Like, my web app search path, I think it's a new innovative product that no one's done before. But someone else might look at it and say, you know, have you seen Google before? You know, have you heard of this thing Google that has a search box? I mean, you're recreating something that's free and that, you know, millions and millions and millions of people use. So I don't know. It's all kind of how you view it and how you market it, I guess.
Yep. Well, Manton, I'm just gonna keep going after these existing markets, and you keep going after all new innovations, and we'll see who wins. How's that sound? Because
<Right.
laughs> that's what it comes down to. This is all just a contest between you and me, Manton.
Right. We're gonna have to start publishing our revenue on the podcast. And see. Have a little chart of who's ahead.
There you go.
You're way beyond me in successful products. I have lots of little niche products, but I don't know. Maybe one of these days, one of them will hit a little bigger.
You're way ahead of me in actually releasing new products, and that's something.
Okay, we're happy to be sponsored again by Microsoft today. Windows Azure Mobile Services supplies a scalable and secure backend for your iOS app. With only a few lines of code, you can store data in the cloud, add user authentication via Facebook or Twitter, and send push notifications. Partnerships with SendGrid, Twilio, and Pusher let you send email and SMS, as well as add real-time functionality to the app while managing your credentials for all of the services from a single pane of glass. Everyone can get free mobile services for 10 apps by signing up for the 90-day free trial today. Learn more about what you can do with mobile services by visiting www.windowsazure.com/iOS.
Yes, thanks again, Windows Azure Mobile Services, for sponsoring the show. And you know, Manton, that's actually, here's an example. Windows Azure, this is something Microsoft does very well. They go into existing markets. Mm-hmm. And you had plenty of experience with other cloud-based service providers when you started looking at Windows Azure Mobile Services. And that it was that previous experience that gave you the yardstick against which to measure. You know, I remember when you tried Windows Azure's interface for the first time, you were like, this is so much easier to set up than some of the stuff you had been using before. Mm-hmm. I was looking at it like, it is. I don't know. I've never done anything like this before.
Right. I had something to compare it to. That's true. That's a good point.
And so you kind of have like an educated market that knows, hey, this is actually a good thing. And so that speaks well to Windows Azure, that so many people, I think, are having this reaction when they go in and check this out. Like I said, Manton, I don't know this stuff like the back of my hand, but you know, I know that some of these services, like, you know, sending push notifications, you can get that service from another company. You can get cloud data hosting from another company. Some of the stuff that Microsoft provides here is probably completely unique, but mm-hmm. The fact is, they're coming in and saying, we're Microsoft, we are good at building strong, reliable, scalable stuff, and we can do it better than those other people can.
Right. And mobile services is really interesting because it is different than some of these others. Because mobile services is this kind of layer on top of Azure. And Azure, you know, can do everything. You can spin up different virtual machines and run whatever you want. But mobile services kind of sits on top of that to provide this really simple interface for, you know, being a data storage in the cloud for your iOS app. And so that's what kind of makes it really unique. And it's, but again, it's similar to, like, I think we talked about Parse.com one point recently. They were bought out by Facebook. And so maybe some people don't like that and they want to consider something else. Well, now they have some comparison that they can make, like you're saying, because it's that same kind of, I've got a blob of data with these different fields and I want to put it in the cloud without having to worry about managing a database and being a, you know, system administrator.
Yep. All the terms of what is a potential advantage are clear to the people who are targeted by this. So it's good for those folks, but it's also good, folks, if you have no idea what the terms are and you just know that you need to, i.e. get some data onto a cloud and push some data notifications to your iOS apps. So go check them out if you haven't already, www.windowsazure.com/iOS. Thanks again. All right. Well, Manton, you know, our friend Marco Arment is selling stuff left and right. He is, well, it only feels like that because he sold a controlling interest in Instapaper a few weeks ago. And then, like clockwork, Tumblr was sold to Yahoo. And then just last week or so, he announces that he has sold the magazine, the internet publication, the iPad publication, rather, that he only came out with 6 months ago or something. He sold it to the editor of the magazine, whom he had hired, Glenn Fleischman. It just seems like he is pretty good at divesting.
Yeah, he's on a roll. It's great. And it he's working on something new. We don't know exactly what it is. Actually, I don't know when it is at all. not even exactly. But yeah, it feels like, you know, he's clearing his plate. You know, I'm sure he loved each of these three things in different ways. But, you know, being able to move on, let somebody else sort of take it from there and work on something new. That's great. I'm jealous of that ability, the opportunity and the ability to do that, because I have a real hard time just delegating any tasks at all. I think a lot of programmers are like that. It's like, we want to control this and we want to write every line of code ourselves. And I can barely hand off any work. And to be able to not only hand off a part of the product, but hand off the entire thing and trust that someone else is going to take it and do a great job with it is pretty awesome skill to be able to have.
Yeah. And it's a kind of like a little packet of skills, because you have to have the skill to start something. You have to have the skill to execute completion of a product, and it has to be good enough that somebody actually wants to buy it from you.
True.
Then you have to have all those skills you were mentioning about being willing to, like, break free and, kind of lose control over your product. And this actually starts to segue into a question we got from a listener, because then you have to have the wisdom or luck to figure out how to sell the product to a buyer who's going to actually do right by the product and by your customers. So getting to that question, we have a question from Dave Perry, who sent in by email question based on his own experience. He says, I have an iOS app in the entertainment category, which has been quite successful. I'd like to sell the app and the company. A bigger player could make more of it than I can, and I'd like to do other things. My question is, how can I find a suitable buyer?
That's a great question. And you have some experience here acquiring apps. And I don't have much experience in selling an app. The one app that I probably should have sold to someone, WeTransfer, I just decided to stop developing it and just kind of closed it down instead. And in hindsight, you know, maybe I should have made more of an effort to give it to someone else and let them run with it. But so I don't know if I have a lot of good advice. I mean, he says it's a successful app, you know, and so I think having that track record of sales and revenue is obviously super helpful to be able to sell it off to someone else.
Yeah, and it's tricky with just as a disclaimer, yes, I have acquired software. I've never sold the rights to software that I own to another company or anything like that. So I can't really answer from experience, but some of the stuff that came up when I was acquiring stuff is similar from the seller point of view, in that, for example, it's not the kind of thing you really want to have out there in the open. Like we talked about this a while back, actually, Manton, with that Cheddar app that was for sale. And that was an example where it was wide open, out in the wide open. In general, I don't think that's a great idea, because it sends the message to all of your customers that things are coming to either an end or to an abrupt shift. So as far as like presenting things to the customer, I think it's really smart to have something lined up in secret, and then a plan that you can convey to the customers that says, check this out, this is going to be good for you. Like when I bought Mars Edit from NewsGator, the company that, you know, Brent Simmons had sold it to previously, it was announced that I was buying it, and there was like a Q&A between me and Brent Simmons on Daring Fireball, and there was like a FAQ, and you know, a transitional like frequently asked questions list on the seller's site, and my site had like a friendly like welcome to all my new customers, and all of this stuff helped smooth over the transition in a way that there's something about like an open call for acquisition that makes an app feel like damaged goods to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to get rid of this thing. I don't really love it anymore.
Yep.
It's a clue to the customers that they maybe should think about. Yeah. Just at least keeping their eye open for competition in case they have to jump ship.
Yeah. So just not from experience, but just from sort of like, hey, I can have an opinion about everything. I would say the way to approach this, Dave, if you want to find somebody who will not only have the money to pay you what the app is worth, but has the sort of like aesthetics and like product prioritization to make the app go on the way you'd like, it seems to me that being, as you said, you're already in this market, you already have been, by your own words, quite successful. You must have a sense for who the competitors in the market are. Mm-hmm. You must have a sense for what their standards of behavior are, how much money they likely have. You know, you said in particular looking for a bigger company to make more of it than you can. I don't know if that means like, you know, and we don't know specifically what the app is, entertainment category. I don't know if that means it's more suitable for somebody like Netflix or somebody like Zynga or somebody like, you know, MLB baseball.
Yeah.
But you probably know very well which category it falls into. And I don't think it's unreasonable to just make a short list of the companies that you think, you know, could do well with this thing. And to be honest, I haven't sold software this way myself, but I've known lots of people who have. And the way it's always played out among the people I know has been through that kind of technique. Like, I want to sell this to somebody who cares about it or who will do well by it, and then go down the list from like top ideal, you know, buyer.
Yeah.
And see how things go. Like, you know, start with companies you admire. Like if this was in the Mac realm, if let's say you were a Mac developer who had like a promising blog editor, then you might come to me and say, hey, this isn't working out for me, I want to sell my blog editor, and you would at least have a sense that I know how to like steward a blog editor.
And I think, as you said, the app is successful, and so I think that will help him narrow down, you know, kind of the list of potential people that he wants to reach out to. Because it's, if the app wasn't super successful, I mean, anyone maybe would want to buy it. But because he wants it a bigger company than he already is to take it on, that really kind of, I think, limits the scope of like the types of companies that are actually going to be able to acquire it. And speaking of being able, I wonder what you think, Daniel, about kind of the terms that people should use when they sell or acquire software. Because you mentioned this app, Cheddar app, And we talked a bunch about the fact that he wanted $125,000 for it. And that was very clear. This is how much I think it's worth. I put a year of my time into it. It's got all these different versions, whatever. You pay me that much and I'll give it everything to you. And then that's it. Deal's done. Right?
Yeah.
Although maybe he threw in like 20 hours of work or something like that. I can't remember. But basically the deal is done. But a lot of things that I hear from people when they acquire an app is very different than that. It's more like, I will give you a little bit of money or maybe none at all. And what we'll do is we'll take on, the new owner will take on the responsibilities for the app immediately, development and support. But it'll be kind of a revenue share deal for a time period. So like, let's say I have a blogging app that I want to sell to you. You don't give me any money or you give me some small amount up front, but we split the sales for like a year, right? And then the next year, maybe you get, you know, 75% or 90%, and I only get, you know, a smaller percent. And then eventually you have complete ownership of it. And that, I don't know, I've heard that from a few people, and I wonder, does that make sense? Is that, it appeals to someone like me who doesn't have $125,000 to buy a Cheddar app. But I wonder how common that is or if that makes sense in a deal like this.
I think it's very common and it's a necessity in many respects for people of our small size. You know, for people with limited resources, as Manton, you and I, and many of our indie developer friends, we don't have like a venture capital backed company to finance forking down $125,000 on something.
Right.
So, I just think it's a creative solution that is by necessity if the, you know, if the entity you're selling to doesn't have a ton of cash. Now that said, it could be, it has other advantages too, in that like when you do something like a revenue share, you kind of hold on to some stake in the app in case the buyers make it into like a runaway success. You know, like the Dave, the questioner here says he thinks a bigger player could make more of it than he can.
Right.
It might make a lot of sense if he could work it into the deal to say, hey, why don't I stay on as a, you know, contributor or engineer for the app or whatever, whatever it is he does exactly.
Or just an advisor.
Or just an advisor, and I'll take 25% of the revenues or something.
Mm-hmm.
If the bigger company could make it that much more of a success, if they make it 10 times as successful, then he's making more money than he was as the sole proprietor for it.
Right. And it's a lot more appealing to the buyer, a lot less upfront. I mean, obviously they have to share the revenue over the next year or however long the contract is, but it makes it easier to hand the app off right away.
Yep. So I think it would come down to, first of all, does the buyer have the cash? Is it even in the realm of possibility to make it an all-cash transaction? And second of all, is there some strong reason for the seller to need it to be a cash transaction? For example, like sometimes these things actually do get bought and sold because the seller really needs the money, you know? Like sometimes, mm-hmm. I've seen these things go down where it's like, oh, I'd really like to keep developing this app, but I'm going to grad school and I'm not going to have any money unless I get $50,000 for this thing by September. Yeah. Yeah. In that case, the revenue share is probably not going to cut it. So that person would then be probably sort of obligated to find somebody who has access to $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But you know, this, yeah, the gist of your question, Manton, or of what you brought up is that yes, there are all manner of creative ways you can arrange an acquisition. And like, for example, going back to Marco, neither of us knows how he arranged his transactions. The terms were not disclosed. It may be that he got $0 from Glenn Fleischman. He may have gotten $100,000. I don't know what it is. But that's the point is, you know, adults can sign contracts with each other that make that make the deal. And that's how it does. But, you know, just closing up with Dave's question, I think just bear in mind that you know the product better than anybody right now, and you probably have a good sense for how to form a short list of potential buyers. And then once you have that list, I don't think there's anything wrong with making a discreet inquiry to a company or an individual. And people, you know, generally are pretty good about being discreet. Just say, you know, I don't want this to get out, but I'm thinking about selling, and I think you would be an ideal, you know, company or person to take the app on. And yeah, that kind of stuff goes down all the time, and deals are sometimes made and sometimes not. So that's the way I would approach it. All right, well, Manton, there's one more question I want to take from a listener, which if we don't take it now, it will be irrelevant until next year. It comes from on Twitter from Felipe Cipriano, who asks, what do you guys decide, or how do you guys decide which WWDC party to go to? There are lots of them.
That's true. There are way too many now, it seems like. I mean, not too many, but there's way more than there, you know, ever used to be. And you'll probably, I don't know, you won't be able to go to everything. There's probably some conflict or on one night where you want to be somewhere and there's something else going on. I tend to just, every night I'm only going to be there until Thursday morning. So really only a few of the main nights. And every night there's kind of like one thing that I really want to be at. And so I've kind of, tentatively, I mean, I have a little list of things that I want to do that week, and I've tentatively just marked, you know, that night, the kind of the one main thing that I want to do, and then a couple other things that are also going on, and if that works out, then that's great.
Yeah, it can be challenging. In general, my general advice is find the smallest party you can and go to it, because some of the bigger parties are just, I mean, they're just, unless that's your thing, unless your thing is like, you know, big, loud music, big crowds, losing everybody in the crowd, then go to those for sure. And not to speak ill of any of these large parties, they're large because they're put on by people who know how to throw a great party and lots of people come to them. But often you can have a lot of fun just finding like this little kind of sideshow party where, you know, it's kind of like we've talked before, Manton, about small conferences versus big conferences. Like the big conferences, sure, like WWDC are great, but small conferences are great because you actually have a chance of talking to everybody there. And that's one thing I would say is just, you know, if you have to choose between a huge party and a small party, maybe go to both, but maybe just, you know, pop into the huge party, see how things are going, and then give the small parties a chance, because there's a good chance you will enjoy them just as much as the larger parties by nature of their less kind of hectic nature.
Yeah. And also I would recommend not over planning and trying to like ahead of time figure out exactly where you're going to be, because I mean, you know, part of the fun of going to these conferences, going to a different city, is not knowing exactly, you know, who you're going to meet or where you're going to end up. And Keep it. I wouldn't try to like in advance plan every little party you're going to go to and exactly what time you're going to be there.
Yeah.
Try to keep it fairly flexible. So, you know, if something great comes up or you meet someone that you want to hang out with or whatever, then that opportunity is there.
Yeah. I mean, I think I do something roughly like you do, Manton. I have on my iCal just gets filled up with all the things that are possibilities for the night. And then I sort of know in my mind which ones I really don't want to miss. So, either, you know, sometimes it's something at the level of, it's like a personal engagement. Like I've said to somebody who's throwing a party, I will see you at your party. And then it's like, I don't want to miss that if I've sort of made that promise. Other times it's like, oh, this would be fun to go to if I get the chance and I know that nobody's expecting me necessarily. And if I have to miss it, I have to miss it. So that goes on the calendar and you just see how things go. And sometimes you will be surprised. You'll end up at one of these parties that maybe you didn't think you were going to be at as long as you want to, but it just turns out that that's, you know, that's where you hit your stride. I guess in the last thing I would say to Felipe is, yes, there are lots of parties. And the good news is at WWDC, you can't go that wrong. If you just go out and I think I said something about this a week or two ago, Manton, if you just go out of your hotel room and find other nerds, then you will have somebody interesting to talk to. And it can be hard. I remember how it was. You know, I'm lucky these days. I know a lot of people at WWDC, but I remember being the wallflower a lot and having trouble, you know, sort of breaking the ice with people. But try to get yourself to do that. Just say, you know, so what do you work on? You know, are you an iOS developer? Are you a Mac developer? Say something to anybody and see where it goes. And you will find that you won't really have picked the wrong party. There's not worth worrying about whether you picked the wrong party, as long as there are people that you want to see and, you know, you can enjoy talking to them.
Okay. Well, thanks again for the questions. And thanks, everyone, for listening. As we said, we're going to take next week off. I'm not going to record a show, but we'll be back the week after WWDC to talk about what the conference was like. And it was great talking to you. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good, Manton. I look forward to seeing you.
Bye.